deacon in this diocese for a long time. And while many of you might not know Andrew, he spent the last days before he died from cancer serving as a member of the St. Bridges congregation, this service that we're at today. And so with Andrew on my mind, I have been also rereading a book called The Divine Magician by an Irish philosopher, Peter Rollins. And it's not just because St. Patrick's Day was yesterday or whatever, but you know, it's good to read from the Irish every now and again. And that book was one of the, I lent that book to Andrew in the last days before he died. And I found out later that he decided that that was going to be the last book that he read, because it brought up so many questions and it brought so many answers and things into focus before he passed away. And so with Andrew on my mind and having read this this book recently, I thought that I would actually tell one of Peter Rollins' parables tonight rather than make anything up myself. And this is sort of loosely cribbed from one of Peter's earlier books called How Not to Speak of God. Slightly adapted for the context. Imagine living in a Vancouver where Christianity has become illegal overnight. We all know Vancouver's seemingly benign indifference to Christian faith. It's what we, for many years, have taken for granted. It's the character of this corner of the world. But imagine, just imagine that this city and this province have finally realized that Christianity is in fact at odds with the desired civil order. And Christians, true Christians, have become enemies of the state. One night, a well-known preacher is arrested, accused of insurrection. A week or two later, the preacher is brought before the court. Members of the prosecution have assembled a striking case. They start it all off by turning to the preacher's Instagram feed, as you do these days. The occasional photo of a family member or a beautiful sunset from East Vancouver, that's there. But it's peppered in and amongst photo after photo of the preacher in church. Pictures at the pulpit, leading Bible studies, lighting a candle, sharing the Eucharist, expounding on what the Christian life is all about. There are even some inspiring quotes from celebrity pastors next to food pics from the latest church potluck. Image after image makes it obvious that the preacher spends much of their time in and around church, at religious events, prayer services, and conferences. And then there are the photos of the preacher's bookshelf, all the latest theological titles, some even signed by their authors. Shameless selfies in coffee shops reading the latest titles. And a scan of Twitter shows the mounting tally of retweets of favored religious podcasts and musicians. But then the prosecution brings out the big guns, demanding an account of the jewelry, the icons, the religious art, and even the design for a Jesus tattoo yet to be inked. The prosecution continues to ramp it up, revealing the preacher's earnest poetry and searching journal entries, deep spiritual wrestling on every page. And then, in closing, they bring out the preacher's well-worn Bible. They point to the margin notes, to passages underlined and highlighted, more and more evidence that the preacher has read and reread this sacred book from cover to cover. As the evidence mounts, the preacher begins to quake. Their brows saturated by sweat, they feel the pressure growing deep within. The knot in the stomach tightens. The heart beats faster and faster. Imprisonment, perhaps even death, is inevitable. The preacher tries to keep it cool, feeling that they will deny Jesus at any moment. It's not true. It's all lies. I renounce Jesus. But they don't. Even though the temptation is there, the preacher stays strong. They keep quiet. Before returning to chambers, judge asks the preacher if they have anything to say. But they say nothing. They're led from the courtroom as the judge ponders the case. Time passes. Time passes and passes until the preacher is finally summoned back to the courtroom to hear the verdict. The judge enters the room. Preacher and judge remain standing. The judge's eyes lock with the preacher's. Time passes. What is the judge looking for? Is it a grain of truth, a confirmation of guilt? God only knows what. And then the moment of truth. Of the charges brought forward, the judge pronounces, I find the defendant not guilty. The preacher's face betrays a sense of disbelief. And then, a split second later, fear and terror are transformed into confusion and rage. The preacher stands before the judge, finger pointing, blood boiling, demanding to know how such a thing is possible in light of all of the evidence. What evidence? The judge replies in shock. I don't see any evidence of Christianity here. And the preacher goes back through the entire case, dumbfounded, pointing to sermon after sermon, to the well-worn Bible, the religious music and books. The judge smiles sadly and says again, I don't think that any of this warrants a charge. Your sermons show that you are a preacher and a poet. Your journals show that you like to write. You may have fooled others and you may have even fooled yourself, but the judge looks the preacher in the eye. Looks the preacher in the eye as if revealing a long-forgotten secret and says, this court is indifferent towards your Bible reading and worship attendance, but until you live as Christ lived, until you're seen sticking your neck out to give yourself in self-giving love to your neighbor, I don't see any reason to charge you. It strikes me that tonight's reading from John's Gospel has a similar punchline. A group of Greeks walk up to Philip. Some tourists wander into a downtown cathedral, and they say, hey, Philip, hey, preacher, we want to see Jesus.